Man, a lot of people want to know how much their school district got in funding. I've been answering the tweets as quickly as I can with all that information, but I do have the change in funding, the increase in funding that that all the school districts got, thanks to Senator Dave Osmek for leaving that information with me. So if you want to know, hit me up on Twitter, Andrew Lee TCNT, or use the hashtag TCNT and ask me, and I will do my best to answer as many as I can.
That was a great game show.
That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. A lot of people wanted to know. John Justice, Under the Weather, will not be in today. Max Reimer from the Kip and Max Save the World podcast sitting in with me this morning. Hopefully, John
will be
back and feeling better tomorrow for the Friday roundtable. But we are joined by regular guest, friend of the show, former special assistant to the president and press secretary to the vice president, Mark Lotter. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thanks for taking
Mark.
Thanks for taking some time and joining us. There was a piece in the, I want to get to this piece in the New York Times about Mike Pence and this sort of narrative that's being pushed by portions of the media that Mike Pence is trying to control Republican politics, and there's a rift between him and the Trump camp heading into the midterms. But before we get to that and throw you a little bit of a curveball, I wanted to give you a chance to comment on the revelation yesterday from Rudy Giuliani, basically saying that he was told by Robert Mueller's team that there will be no indictment of the president, that they can't indict the president. And my response to that is, well, if that's the case, then why not just wrap up this investigation and get it over with?
Well, I am not a lawyer, so I would not even entertain the idea of questioning Rudy Giuliani, his legal interpretation. But it's been long-standing policy of the Justice Department, and to say that you cannot indict a sitting president of the United States. And so it sounds like what Rudy was saying is that the Bob Mueller team was telling him that they cannot do anything beyond what that long-standing policy has been. And what we know, I mean, as we enter the second year now of this investigation, after millions of documents, hundreds of interviews with people for thousands of hours, there has still been no evidence of any collusion. And as the vice president said, as many others have said, it's time for them to wind down this investigation, bring it to the conclusion, and let's move on with the business of the American people.
Yeah, it would be one thing, and I think we would be much better served if this investigation were more focused on, revealing what the efforts were from Russian interests to meddle, influence, possibly attempt to collude, whatever it may be, and provide recommendations on what we can do about that, and less about sort of this, and I didn't think it was this at the beginning, but I've come around on it. What it essentially has turned out to be a witch hunt for anything on anybody associated with the Trump campaign.
And we saw from previous information that has come out and been made public that the goal was for the Russians to seed chaos. And while they were, as soon as the president was elected, they were promoting rallies and counter rallies in New York City and other places, both in for and against the president. It was clear that their designs have been from day one to create confusion, have people question the legitimacy of our system of government and our elected leaders. And that's just something that we cannot tolerate as a country. But we should not use that as an excuse to try to undo the will of the people from a year ago, November. And let's move on and get the business of the people done. They see it working. That's why we see the president's poll approval ratings going up. Despite the noise and nonsense coming out of the D.C. media elite, we see the generic ballot closing to it's been cut almost in half in the last 6 months between Republicans and Democrats. And that's because the American people see the results that the president and Republicans are producing. It's what they elected them for.
Mark, it's like you mentioned, we are coming up on, and I think you mentioned 1 year of this investigation. To me, just personally, it feels like this thing is sunsetting. There is no logical conclusion to it. Mueller has to save face in some form or fashion. He has to come up with something. He has to present. Eventually, this information needs to get presented to the American people in some form or fashion. You have the story yesterday that you have a couple of Russian firms that are asking for evidence from his team, and his team's not coughing up any evidence. Where do you see this going? Where is this heading? Because it has to reach conclusion. But at this point in time, like you mentioned, they don't have anything. It's not looking like they're going to have anything. And Mueller's got a reputation to save. Where's the logical end to this?
I think the logical end is in the near term. And I think Bob Mueller, who has a long history of credibility, and it will come to the conclusion that we have all shown for the last year that there was no collusion. And if anything, it will, along with the Inspector General report that's supposed to be coming out shortly and other information that keeps to be leaking out of the Department of Justice, it will also prove that the FBI and the Justice Department, by a small handful of people, not the rank and file, but the small handful at the very top under the previous administration, misused our justice system and the FBI to spy on Americans, spy on the campaign, collude with others in covering up crimes that they had uncovered by the other side, and this has been nothing more than a partisan witch hunt, and then I think the people will move on.
Donald Trump, the president, tweeted a little while ago, about 17 minutes ago, word seems to be coming out that the Obama FBI spied on the Trump campaign with an embedded informant. Andrew McCarthy says there's probably no doubt that they had at least one confidential informant in the campaign. Trump says, if so, this is bigger than Watergate. I don't know that that's going to get any traction, though. I think, you know, it just seems like any allegations that seem to come from the president or the administration just sort of get shrugged off and dismissed as that's just Trump being Trump. Yet, you know, they're so willing to, the same people are so willing to buy this ridiculous narrative of, you know, Russia collusion with the Trump campaign. It's really frustrating to look at.
It's clear that in many circles, especially here in Washington, D.C., and in the media, that if they don't have Russia to talk about, they're not going to have anything to talk about, because they don't want to cover the growing economy, our strength on the world stage,
right,
the president's successes in nominating judges, rolling back regulations that are putting more people in our country to work, resulting in higher paychecks. And if they had to actually talk about those good things, they would go on to something else.
And it ties in nicely with the reason we brought you on, and thank you for indulging us on that topic for a few minutes, Mark Lauder. But it ties in with the reason we brought you on. The midterm elections are coming up, and the Democrats, they need a strong narrative. They're looking for anything to grab onto for the midterm elections. We are seeing, you know, genuine positive results from Trump policies, regardless of what you think about Trump the man, Trump the person, Trump's personality, all of the bravado and bombasticness that sort of comes that sort of follows him around. The policies that have been implemented since he's been president are really hard to argue, you know, that they haven't been extremely positive, and mostly domestically, but even on the foreign policy stage. So we're going into these midterm elections. Democrats are running on this idea that there's going to be a blue wave. You've even got a segment of the Democrat candidates that are using impeachment as the reason why they need to get more seats in the House, the reason why they need more seats in Congress. There's a piece in the New York Times talking about Mike Pence's role on the Republican side. What do you think about, and what are your thoughts on the, we know what the Democrats are going to run on, and it remains to be seen if it's actually going to work. I'm not terribly confident that it will, but we know what they're going to run on. What, when you look at the Republicans' strategy to sort of push back on these narratives and talk about the successes, what role does Mike Pence play in that?
I think the vice president will play a very large role in the fact that back early this year, the president, the vice president, the leaders in Congress got together at Camp David to map out how 2018 would play out. And the president wanted the vice president to be the, quote, tip of the spear. It's a lot easier to move the vice president around. This is something the vice president is used to doing from 12 years in Congress, 4 years as governor of Indiana. He's very accustomed to being on the fundraising and the campaign trail. And so you'll see the vice president continue to go out across America, talk about the benefits of Republican leadership, the tax cuts, raise money for Republican candidates and office holders who seek to support the president's agenda and why we need them in Congress. I was with the president and vice president last week in Indiana when they held a rally there. And I'll tell you, not only were there 8,500, 9,000 people in that gymnasium, but what you didn't see on television was the thousands of people who lined the streets for miles to hold signs, wave flags, and get a glimpse of the motorcade going by with the vice president and president there in the lead. That's the kind of energy we have right now in America. And people who aren't on the left coast or the lefter coast, they get it. They see it. They see it in their paychecks. And I think that's why you'll see the vice president continue to be out there. He's going to support the president's agenda and candidates who are doing it. The vice president and the president, they talk multiple times a day. They know exactly what each other are doing. And as I said in USA Today yesterday, it's actually funny that just in the last week, the vice president has been accused of being too loyal to the president while also at the same time running a shadow campaign 50 feet from the Oval Office. It's just how Washington works. None of it's true. And it's just another distraction to keep from talking about what's going on in our country.
Mark, I want you to kind of pull out your crystal ball one more time here. You had made mention before that you think the inevitable conclusion to the Mueller investigation is going to lead to him coming out and saying basically nothing happened. You know, we have a senator in this, or a senatorial candidate in this state who is running on the Democrat side of the aisle. He's going to the primary. He's basically running his entire campaign on anti-Trumpism, on the resistance movement. Literally no other substance. It's Richard Painter, the former ethics guy for George W. Bush. He's decided he's a Democrat now. And the only thing that he's running on is anti-Trump, because he perceives Trump to be this kind of corrupt official. We understand that Trump policies are working. I think a lot of the polling actually has Democrats backing off of tax reform as a criticism because it's working so well. If this thing resolves prior to midterms, the implications of that for Democrats are catastrophic. This blue wave goes down a big red drain, so to speak. Do you see it resolving before then? Or you said Bob Mueller's a guy with integrity. He wouldn't drag this out past the point of those elections, would he?
I really have faith that Bob Mueller will conclude the investigation when he believes it has reached its conclusion. Many people believe that time is very close. I know Rudy Giuliani has encouraged it to wrap up as quickly as possible, because if there has not been evidence of collusion, which is what they were supposed to find, more than a year later, after over a million documents, hundreds of interviews, thousands of hours of testimony, you're not going to find it because it was not there. And I don't think he would continue it for political reasons. I don't think he would end it short for political reasons. I think he'll wrap it up when he believes that is the course of action, and I would encourage him to do that, because what we've seen so far does not show any kinds of signs of collusion, because there wasn't any, as the president said. But you're absolutely right. Democrats don't have a message right now other than resistance. And the voters in Minnesota need to ask themselves, because we came really close to winning Minnesota in 2016, about a point and a half. And I think we can get there because people are going to see those results in their paychecks. They see jobs coming back to our country that had long gone. They see unfair trade deals being changed to the benefit of American companies and American workers. And if Richard Painter and the Democrats want to continue to oppose that, I think it's going to be up to the voters of Minnesota and many other places to say, well, we may not like all the style, we may not like all the substance of the words and how they're said, but you can't argue with the results, so let's keep that going. And I have faith that the voters will do so.
Well, indications are pointing that way, Mark Lauder. They really are. I mean, there's a Gallup poll that's out just now that records the level of satisfaction with the way things are going in the country, and they recorded their highest level of satisfaction since September 2005. It's up to 37%. Since the 2005, there was a 39% level of satisfaction with the way things are going right now. So we're almost at the peak over the last 13 years. So
absolutely. And unemployment's the lowest rate in 18 years. And on top of that, we have more job openings right now, unfilled job openings in our country than we have ever had in history. And when you look at that compared to low unemployment, that means wages are going to go up because companies are going to have to compete harder to attract new talent or keep the existing workers they have. There's a study out this morning that says 72% of manufacturers are increasing wages and benefits. 77% are going to hire more workers. Nearly 90% are going to invest in new equipment and facilities. That all means more people to build that equipment, to staff those facilities. It's a great time to be in the job market right now. And the one thing I would say for those young people who are graduating from college and high school in this month and in the next weeks, if you're looking to get a job, you've never had a better chance in your entire life than right now. And it's because of strong conservative leadership. And that's something we've got to keep going.
Yeah, I saw a stat the other day, and I'm pulling this off memory, so forgive me if I'm a little off. But, you know, for the first time in a long time, you've got nearly like a one-to-one ratio of people looking for jobs and available jobs. You've got, you know, there are jobs out there for everybody that wants one.
You're absolutely right. And why would we want to turn back and go back to the policies that had slow growth, stagnant wages, a media out there that was trying to tell us this is the new normal, when the president said, no, it's not. We can get back to the same kind of growth we used to have. We can get back to the same confidence that we had back in the 80s and other times. All we have to do is just get the government off the back of the people, back off the back of the companies, and we will grow again, and we're doing it.
Mark Lauder, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Always a pleasure. Always enjoy our chats.
Look forward to coming back, guys.
All right, thanks, Mark. Real soon. That is Max Reimer in for John Justice this morning. We want to hear from you, 651-989-5855. Next, we will dive into the bold and controversial decision of Tim Pawlenty to forego the convention, to forego the endorsement process, and jump right to a primary. It's got a lot of people fired up. Want to hear what you think, so give us a call, 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Phone number, because we are going to want to hear from you in these next couple segments, 651-989-5855. Joined by Max Reimer, who's sitting in for John Justice this morning, who's under the weather, hopefully back tomorrow for the roundtable. Before we get into all of the latest drama in the Minnesota gubernatorial race, at least on the GOP side, have you seen the story out of Brainerd? The monster bog of Brainerd.
I have not.
Brainerd is dealing with a monster bog from the Star Tribune. They tried pushing it. They tried pulling it. They tried cutting it in half. And the monster bog of the Brainerd Lakes just laughed. Just laughed at their efforts. In the ongoing struggle of man versus nature, nature won a unanimous decision yesterday. A day-long effort at North Long Lake failed to dislodge the giant floating mat of muck, bulrushes, and tamarack trees that grounded onshore last fall at Legionville, a training camp for Minnesota School Patrol Guards. Kevin Martini, an official with the Brainerd Office of DNR, said, "It kicked our butts."
Wow.
Let's just be honest here. We never thought it would be this much trouble. More than 36 volunteers attacked the bog around 7 a.m. with a flotilla of boats packing thousands of horsepower, trying to pull the bog offshore. The bog refused to budge. Around dinner time, workers finally succeeded in slicing the bog in half using a steel cable, and we're preparing to make another try at pulling at least half the bog off the beach. I just like saying bog. Just fun to say.
When do you think the event, the next Avengers movie comes out where they face a giant bog like that?
Right. Yeah, just get the sick Thanos on it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Hey, it is another dramatic impact of man-made climate change. They warn you about the bogs that come to life and kill people. That's another caveat to that whole deal.
It's going to be the next installment in the Scream franchise.
But listen, you think I'm kidding? Just wait for the next Sierra Club press release. So,
another story out of San Francisco. So Jacob Frey, Minneapolis, has put an emphasis on affordable housing, right? Another city that's been run by those of the liberal persuasion.
Jacob Fries.
For the Jacob Fry types for a very, very, very long time is San Francisco. San Franciscans, if you want to buy a median-priced home in San Francisco, take a guess at what your annual income needs to be if you want to be able to afford a median-priced single-family home in the Bay Area.
I'm going to take a stab. And I'm going to say 90,000.
$333,000 a year. $333,000 a year. That needs to be your annual income if you want to afford a median-priced home in the Bay Area.
That is more than the Randolph School District got in funding this year.
Right?
What the heck?
In San Francisco and San Mateo counties, only 15% of households could afford a median-priced home. Average of a median-priced home in those areas is between $1.6 and $1.5 million during the first quarter.
Oh, that is just incredible.
That's the median price of $1.5 to $1.6 million. So,
yeah. And what's funny about San Francisco specifically is there are a couple other stories about the homeless population in San Francisco and how they're not even able to accommodate them. And then, oh, by the way, progressive people in San Francisco who we always hear about their compassion, they're not willing to let their neighborhood look a certain way to accommodate those people. It's all a virtue signal, man. It really is.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do, there's a worldview sort of disconnect there in that if you believe the government is supposed to be responsible for handling certain types of social problems, certain types of issues,
right,
dealing with a homeless problem, something like that. If you believe the government, then you're abdicating yourself of that responsibility. So those that are most prone to turn to the government and expect the government to fix the problem, to deal with a problem, they don't do anything themselves.
Right.
They don't want to have to make any real sacrifice. The only sacrifice they're willing to make is some taxes, but most of that's going to be paid by other people anyway.
Yep.
So that's fine. Just take a little bit out of my paycheck and fix that problem. They don't want to expend any effort. They don't want to make any real sacrifice. They don't want to step in and actually get involved and get their hands dirty. You're never, ever, ever going to solve an affordable housing problem, a homeless problem, by just sort of abdicating the responsibility to the government. It's never going to work. It has never worked.
And it's not compassion.
No, it's not.
It is inherently selfishness to say, I'm not going to help my neighbor, but I expect the government to put a gun to someone else's head and mine to help my neighbor and expect the problem to get solved. But yeah, with the homeless thing in particular, these people don't even want the homeless people in their backyards. So
look at what's going on in Seattle. Okay, you've got this situation in Seattle where they just passed this this per employee tax on businesses, and it's targeted specifically at large businesses,
Amazon and Starbucks specifically.
Like Amazon, Starbucks specifically. It's the abdication of responsibility, and it's a failure to recognize that Amazon, just by existing, has done more to help homeless people, to help the homeless problem, than the government could ever dream of doing, because Amazon employs tens of thousands of people and pays them a decent wage to where they can afford a home.
Yep.
They don't have to find themselves in a situation where they might become homeless. The government could never accomplish and never do nearly as much as Amazon is able to do to deal with a homeless problem.
And to that end, the specific city council member who's actually spearheading the effort, Shama Sawant, if you listen to her justify this, Drew, she talks basically about how she has no justification for it, except she believes they deserve a penalty for being as large as they are.
Right,
listen to her talk. Right, it is really, really disturbing stuff.
She is literally penalizing them for their success. And
she makes no bones about it, by the way. There's not right. there's not this air of common good. There's not this air of course, they want the money to go to poor people. That's the whole point of the initiative. But if you listen to the vitriol and the vengeance in her voice as she talks about these companies, one of which was started right in the heart of Seattle, it's more about the vengeance of having the audacity to grow something that large than it is about helping anybody, which strikes at the heart of progressivism in general. It really does.
The homeless problem in Seattle is largely driven by government policies. It's largely driven by central planning. The demand for housing has far exceeded the supply, and it has exceeded the supply because of zoning laws and zoning restrictions that prevent the building of high density housing in a lot of areas. Most of the Seattle's residential areas are zoned for single family homes. Why? Because the people that live there don't want to look at a big apartment building.
Right.
I don't want to, you know, put that somewhere else.
Right.
So you've got a lot of put that somewhere else mentality that prevents them from increasing their capacity, prevents them from building enough housing to deal with the demand. The problem with housing in Seattle is not there's a cost issue there, but that cost is because the supply of housing has not kept up with the demand for housing. You've got a far more demand than availability. That's not Amazon's fault. The only thing that you could possibly conclude the role that Amazon played in it is that more people are moving there to go work for a great company like Amazon.
That's right. And what does a progressive solution look like? Well, it looks like what they did in Portland, where basically they're like, hey, we know we have a huge issue. We know we have several problems. And then you literally had the Portland City Council talking about a solution where you would allow a certain amount of homeless people to be able to pitch tents in your backyard. That's what a progressive solution looks like. Right. Imagine thinking that we got a housing crisis, we got a homeless issue, we don't know what to do, we're pretty gentrified, so we don't want to let people be too uncomfortable with low-income subsidized apartment complexes. What is our solution? Well, let's go to our virtue signaling constituency and ask them to put homeless people in their backyard and allow them to live there in tents. It's really... It's almost comical. It's almost The Onion until you're reminded that this is the reality we live in.
Part of me is terrified, but part of me also sort of relishes this lurch towards socialism that we're seeing in certain wings of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania. They had the primaries yesterday or on Tuesday. Four Democratic candidates backed by the Democratic Socialists of America won their primary elections for legislative seats in Pennsylvania. And you're seeing that. You're seeing it in Seattle. You've seen it in Minneapolis. Yep. You know, you've got a growing socialist presence and party in Minneapolis and in St. Paul. And you got a definite wing thanks to Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And that crowd that are taking some strong lurches in that direction. Part of it scares the crap out of me, because I don't want to see it get any traction.
Yeah.
But a bigger part of me is like, yeah, please.
Yeah. And
please continue down that path.
The issue with those people is when their policies fail, they are too prideful to take the blame for those policies and hand the reins over to someone else.
It's never their fault.
Yeah. It's always, well, we need to get more progressive. We need to elect more progressive candidates. And I really do believe on the DFL side, we're going to get into the governor conversation. Listen, that endorsement process and really that primary process is going to run through the Twin Cities Metro. And listen, in Minneapolis, they are having communist candidates succeed in city council races.
Yeah. On the DFL side, and we'll get into the Pawlenty issue here coming up in the next segment. Give us a call, 651-999-5855. But on the DFL side, rather interesting development earlier this week. Saw the SEIU come out and issue an endorsement ahead of the convention.
That is a whole mess.
That's pretty unusual, right?
Yep.
I mean, they just went ahead and threw out their endorsement for Aaron Murphy.
Well, it sounds like, from what I've read, it sounds like there was a local chapter of the SEIU that came out and endorsed, but then the chapter in and of itself didn't meet about it, or there was no communication. There's been several iterations of what they're actually deciding. Mm-hmm. I think their official stance right now, and I could be wrong, is that there's no endorsement.
Okay.
But at first, some chapter went rogue and said, hey, Erin Murphy's our gal.
Yeah.
But just pandemonium. Mm. There's pandemonium all over the place in Minnesota right now.
I love disarray in politics. Yeah,
it makes for a good radio show.
651-989-5855. All right, Tim Pawlenty announced that he will not seek, he is not seeking the endorsement. He is not participating in the convention. He is instead focusing all of his efforts early on straight to the primary. This has caused a lot of very understandable frustration and irritation among Republican delegates, among grassroots Republican activists who have been working towards this. Speaking of disarray, it does throw things in a bit of disarray. Jennifer Carnahan came out with a statement saying that she was disappointed at this development, that they value the endorsement, and that the party will strongly back their endorsed candidate. Sort of clears the field in a sense that I think most people have a very high expectation that Jeff Johnson will end up being the endorsed candidate, and it'll be a primary between Jeff Johnson and Tim Pawlenty. I want to give you a chance to react your thoughts on this at 651-989-5855. We'll share Max Reimer's thoughts and mine coming up right here on Justice and Drew.
Justice and
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Final segment of Justice and Drew for a Thursday. Thank you for spending some time with us this morning. Hopefully, John will be back for the roundtable tomorrow. We do have the roundtable classic coming in tomorrow, I believe. Representative Nick Zerwas and comedian Brian Miller. I do not believe we will be hearing from Tom Emmer. I believe he has to miss this week. His normal Friday hit, but we'll catch up with him again next week. Max Reimer.
Hey.
From the Kip and Max Save the World podcast. Where can people find that podcast?
KipandMax.com. And then we have all sorts of places you can listen, iTunes, Podbean, Google Play, whatever. But go to KipandMax.com. It's a fun website. We typically publish a weekly podcast. It's very issue intensive and Minnesota relatable.
There will be a new episode up later today, I believe, right?
That's right, yes. Hey, are you a Yanny or a Laurel guy?
I haven't even listened to that audio yet. I have not listened to that audio. So I don't know if I'm a Yanny or Laurel guy. I have no idea.
I got you.
All right.
What?
So this whole Laurel Yanny thing is a little bit ridiculous. Give me just a moment here because I will pull up the craziness.
This is the sort of the audio version of his dress.
Oh, it totally is. Yeah. So the internet kind of erupted in disagreement on like Tuesday over this audio clip where some guy it's Laurel. It's definitely Laurel.
Well, I think it is too. It's caused a little consternation in my household because my wife hears Yanny and I. So listen, people, when you hear this clip, you're either hearing the word Yanny or you're hearing the word Laurel. And when Sam plays it here, if you don't hear Laurel, I think you're crazy.
And so this is interesting because I listened to it several times yesterday because I was trying to figure it out. And I listened to it on my phone. I listened to it on a computer. I listened to it on our nice speakers here at the studio. And I always heard Laurel. And then today I went to play it. And like the first, he says it like six times in this clip. And the first time I heard it, listened to it today, I heard Yanny. And then it turned into Laurel again after that. And it just has to do with like frequency and pitches and what your, I don't know, your perception of sound is, basically. So here's the clip. Here's the clip now.
Laurel.
So you either heard Laurel or Yanny.
I heard Laurel.
Some people hear Yanny, I'm telling you.
So interestingly, I found a website that lets you, it has like a slider where you can hear, this tool gradually accentuates different frequencies in the original audio clip.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, depending on which way I slide it, it changes the pitch.
Okay.
So people who hear Yanny are hearing it like this.
Yanny.
So that's how they're hearing.
That's the
Yanny.
Same clip.
That's the same one.
Yes.
Just with different frequencies.
It's been the pitch has been
amplified. Okay.
Yep, the pitch has been changed.
So is the explanation for people that hear Yanny or people that hear Laurel that they are they are more attuned to hearing different frequencies than other, because that is a thing. You know, some people are more sensitive to different audio frequencies than others.
I think that's what it has to do with.
Yeah,
it's got to be, right? Yep. That's the only explanation I can think of that makes sense.
Yeah, that's basically, I actually read like way too many articles on this, and that kind of seems like the general consensus.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah.
Welcome to millennials and younger, man. This is what we spend our time on. We're doomed.
You got no so real weird. Problems.
We don't.
I don't know whose voice this is. It came from, I think it was originally posted by some person on Instagram. And so it's like super, super weird. People who happen to hear Yanny automatically, this is what Laurel sounds like.
Laurel. Laurel.
For anybody who hears Yanny.
So for anybody who heard the original clip and heard Yanny. That's so weird.
Go Google it and then go have a fight with your spouse about it. That seems to be the popular thing to do.
Yeah.
Speaking of fights.
So Tim Pawlenty announced he will not participate in the convention. Will not has sort of abandoned the seeking for the endorsement. Before that, he had always said he would like to get the endorsement and he'll work for it. But you know, his campaign will not end at the endorsement, whether or not he gets it or not. So we all sort of saw the primary coming. But to me, it struck me as odd. It struck me as, you know, you can call it confident. You can call it arrogant. I've heard some people call it that as well. But it definitely struck me as tactically risky to announce that you weren't even going to participate in the convention. It seemed to me that kind of a low effort, you know, thing to at least go make a speech, you know, do the glad handing, shake the hands, you know, make sort of your customary appearance. So, but this is clearly a tactical decision on part of the Pawlenty campaign to say, I'm not even going to participate in the primary.
You know, I'm part of a cable access program where I had an opportunity to interview. It was about 3 weeks ago, both Jeff Johnson and Tim Pawlenty, who people widely consider to be the two front runners. Now, something weird could happen at convention. Sometimes it does. But, you know, really, with Jeff, down home guy, you could have a beer with him. I posted a pretty long Facebook status about this. Very elaborative, very principled. He'd be a great governor. With Tim, it is interesting. You can tell that whatever this thing has been in the works for years. That's my perception of the situation. Mm-hmm. Tim is so precise, so analytical, so data driven. It seems, from what I can tell, that he's running his campaign and nothing is a mistake.
Yeah.
From what I'm seeing,
got almost kind of a sabermetrics.
It feels that way.
To his decision.
So when you think about the timing here, when he was first considering running, there was a Star Tribune article about a little kitchen cabinet meeting he kind of had, and from what I've heard about that meeting, it was centered around keeping resources from the party and not letting the endorsement be as powerful as the endorsement could be. And within this given timing, I think if Tim Pawlenty saw a route to get the endorsement, he would have stuck in there. But I think what Tim is probably trying to avoid from my vantage point here, I don't have any insider baseball on this, but I think he's trying to avoid a non-endorsement. I think he is hoping to go one-on-one with a candidate with a weak endorsement. If you talk to anybody at the party, it's fairly obvious that finances have not been what they had been. And, you know, Jennifer Carnahan is doing a great job. But within this race itself, it feels like everything that Tim Pawlenty is doing is an intentional strategy on a long-term primary victory. Nothing is a mistake. You know, Jeff has really battled for the endorsement. Jeff has battled for the hearts of the delegates. He's gone the more traditional route. It looks to me like Tim is strategizing a different route where he'll have an opponent, he'll have a primary opponent, but he has dried up a lot of the money in the state, a lot of the money in the party that would normally go to the endorsed candidate, to weaken the endorsement. Now, if Tim were to show up at the convention not expecting the endorsement, you could still expect, I think, a split ticket. You could still expect a non-endorsement at the convention. Mm-hmm. by Tim releasing a press release after the party had released its prices of the convention.
Which I've seen a lot of people online complaining about.
Yep, and, but you have to keep in mind that the prices are high because the party has not had the financial donations that it had at the very beginning of Jennifer's tenure as chair. So, all that to be said, the timing of the announcement is fascinating, and then the really hard line, I'm not going to the convention.
Right.
That was also fascinating to me, because what it appears to me is Tim wants to take his name out of the endorsement process now completely to ensure that there is an endorsement. It's a again. I
hadn't really thought about it that way. I did go into this thinking there was a good chance that that there would be a non-endorsement. And that we may have a multi-way primary if that were the case.
No longer. And yeah. I think that was intentional. And I don't mean to get too tinfoil hat on this, but just looking at everything that's been done up to this point and Tim Pawlenty's windfall of fundraising just right off the bat, you can tell that this is an intentional strategy. And there's a lot of people I'm seeing on Facebook. Feelings are hurt, you know, so hopefully we can get some callers in the hopper here because I'd like to hear from people what they think of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm curious to hear as well. There are a lot of people who really, really value the endorsement process, hold it almost to a point of sacredness, and consider it, you know, a bit of a Republican heresy to simply say, yeah, I don't care. Not gonna do it. Not gonna go after it. And you know, I've seen people call it cowardly. I certainly don't look at it that way. I think it's more tactical. You know, it uses up a lot of resources. Uses up a lot of time, uses up a lot of money, which are the only two things. That's the only currency a campaign has,
right?
Is time and money. Right. And it uses up a lot of those to compete for the endorsement. And for whatever reason that you want to attribute to, but Tim Pawlenty has clearly made the calculation that he wasn't going to receive the endorsement. So to me, you know, it's not like a primary is a bad thing. It's not like primaries are not allowed. Constitutionally, you know, that's how Minnesota determines its candidates of who it's going to be on the ballot. Mm-hmm. You know, the endorsement is a function of the party, whereas to actually get on the ballot, you know, a lot of times you're going to end up having to win a primary.
Right.
So there's nothing inherently wrong with the way Tim Pawlenty has chosen to go about this. This is the way that you end up, you know, being the nominee and getting the ballot is by winning a primary. And there are strong arguments on both sides. You know, there's arguments that, you know, if you're going to be on the ballot in November, you know, you got to go through the endorsement. You got to get the support of the party, helps unify the party, makes you a stronger candidate in the general election with a nice unified party behind you. But the other flip side of that argument, which to me is just as valid, if you want to win in November, mm-hmm. you have to demonstrate that you are able to convince people to show up at a polling place and vote for you and fill that little circle next to your name on the ballot. And a primary is a much more representative way of demonstrating that you're able to do that. So I'm not going to sit here and try to pick sides in the primary versus endorsement. That is a function of the party. That's a conversation that has to happen within the party. That is not for me to sit here and say either side is right or wrong. I'm saying there's merit and value on both sides. Now, the point is, if you can't win a primary, whether or not you're endorsed, you can't win in November. Just that simple.
Of course.
If you can't go out there and convince people to show up at a polling place and vote for you in a primary election, you're never going to be able to do it in a much more hostile environment, you know, come November when you've got the DFL and all the money and all of the resources being, you know, targeted at you in November.
Right. Yeah, and the number one criticism seems to be that during Tim Pawlenty's last couple terms as governor is he did not do enough to help the party and to bolster the party. So you have a lot of these activists that have put blood, sweat, and tears. And especially, listen, folks, if you're on social media, you know how passionate the Jeff Johnson supporters are and how much they would go to bat for their candidate. It to a lot of people, it feels like a betrayal when candidates have been campaigning for a year and a half and there's been activists behind them. And you have a guy who comes in and is going to circumvent the whole process. Doing so, I think, analytically and very wisely to a certain extent. But the perception is out there is that he's betraying the entire process.
Can Tim Pawlenty? This is going to be the big question, right? Does this move make it more difficult for Tim Pawlenty? Let's presume for the purposes of this question that Tim Pawlenty is the nominee, right? Tim Pawlenty wins the primary. Can he overcome the sort of hurt feelings and the anger at his tactics, at his tactical decisions so far? Can he overcome enough of that to be able to get enough Republicans to show up and vote for him in November? Or does he not need that percentage of the Republican base that are going to be upset enough by this that they will not vote for him in November?
Well, I think there's definitely two elements to that. The delegation that will be at the convention is basically 1% of potential primary voters in Minnesota on the Republican side. It is
primary or general?
It's probably primary when you think about there's going to be 2,500 or so at the convention. The average primary is usually I could be wrong about that. It's a small percentage of the total primary vote. And then beyond that, they have a microphone too. You know, the delegation is going to be the loudest supporter and the loudest opponent mm-hmm. in this process. It should be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Yeah. This is going to be a really, really fun summer politically. And stay on Justice and Drew. We will, of course, stay on top of it all and cover it all. Thank you, Max Reimer, for sitting in for John.
Thank you for having me.
Hope John is feeling better, and hopefully we'll be with
better,
us
John.
Tomorrow for the roundtable. Representative Nick Zerwas and comedian Brian Miller in tomorrow for the roundtable. Have a wonderful job, everybody. Great job, Sam.
I'm Chris Addison here.